Welcome to the Theatron Project.
Episode 11, Racism in American Mythology. Hello, everybody. If you've been listening regularly, you might know that a few weeks ago, I had a conversation with playwright Sam Gregory. We talked for a while, yet we didn't really have time to dig into his play and the evolving story of the Children of Oedipus. These old stories that fascinate Sam and that fascinate me have layers and layers and layers, and we really just brush up against them as listeners, readers, viewers, and even as adapters. But how do such explorations translate to actual writing? How do they turn into a particular methodology? How do they become a means for me to move forward in adapting The Devil and Tom Walker? Well, there's something in the way that Sam has brought forward the female characters in a story that has long overlooked them, that has really spoken to me. Sure, Antigone and Ismene get quite a few lines in the original tragedies by Sophocles, but Jocasta vanishes from the narrative, and we don't even get to meet the prophetess Manto. Sam changed that. Can I change that too, when thinking about the women in the world of Tom Walker? His wife is the only one we meet. And like Jocasta, she vanishes, but as a punchline. She exists as a misogynistic trope, the cruel, termagant wife. Washington Irving doesn't seem interested in meaningful female representation in this story. But as an adapter, maybe I can be. I can find ways to make my take on this story much more female-driven. And I have, as I've been working on the script. Even doing that, though, am I complicit in the story's misogyny if I don't directly address that which is problematic in the original? I'm finding ways to, I think, I hope, but it haunts me. It should. As we look at where we are as a culture in 2020, we should be haunted by our past. It should spur us to make a better present. In this current cultural moment in America, probably our most visible struggle against the hatred of our past is against our racist traditions. And that is the focus for today. 2020 has certainly demonstrated that America's institutions, both private and public, not only perpetuate systemic racism, but function as a result of it. Sadly, it is deeply intertwined with our history, our politics, our everything. Our priority right now should be to address the ways that it influences public policy. But we must also acknowledge that it runs rampant in the stories that we have told and continue to tell. It is a part of our mythology. How do we deal with that? Especially when we're adapting these stories for today. I don't have a good answer to this, and I won't by the end of the episode. But if we seek to steer our society away from racism, away from the hatred and oppression enacted on so many groups of people, we can't ignore the times it arises in our storytelling tradition. We can't just say, well, that was a different time, and pretend that it's not there. Because it still is there. Not just on the shelf, hiding between the pages, but embedded in the stories of today. If we overlook it, we can't process it. We can't move forward. The authors, playwrights, creators whose work includes and is built on bigotry are many. Many of them were not, are not, hateful people themselves. Some are. H.P. Lovecraft might be among the most egregious, but I won't go down that rabbit hole here and now. A recent episode of Ian Malinsky's podcast, Imaginary Worlds, focuses on Lovecraft's racism and how we're handling it today. I highly recommend listening to that. But whether or not you're able to get to it, know that Malinsky ultimately urges us not to cancel Lovecraft outright. There's wonderful stuff in his mythos, and several writers of color are using it to tell stories of their own. Washington Irving is no Lovecraft, but if you listen to our reading of The Devil and Tom Walker a few weeks back, you'll have heard his references to red men who apparently practice human sacrifice. You'll have heard his description of a great black man in the woods who is the literal devil. Irving was probably just playing on tropes that were common in stories of his time. His stories also featured buried pirate treasure, which seems to exist alongside the racial references and the cruel nagging wife archetype. These things were standard fare in stories of that era. Like I said, though, we can't just dismiss those things because of the time in which they were written. It begs us to look at them through today's lens. As I have attempted to unpack all this, I have been grateful for the opportunity to speak to Cody Walker, educator and writer, about how he approaches The Devil and Tom Walker and other stories with problematic elements. Well, let's go ahead and start kind of by talking. We'll talk kind of through the lens of being an educator. And let's start with what is probably the most directly racist part of The Devil and Tom Walker. The references to the red men who reside in the Indian fort and who have apparently engaged in human sacrifice. I'm sort of doing air quotes, though that's probably not obvious from the audio recording, but this is directly out of Washington Irving's story. You teach The Devil and Tom Walker. How do you handle this stuff when you and your students encounter it in the story?
Part of what I do is I do a lot of front loading. So the very first unit that we go over is, it begins, like the first things we read are Native American origin myths. So we read like an Onondaga myth, an Iroquois myth, and a Modoc myth. And we kind of just explore what does it mean? What do these stories help us understand about culture? What insights do they give us into the cultures of these different tribes and stuff? You could spend a whole year just going over different Native American myths and stories, but it's kind of, it's sort of like a survey of literature class in some ways, I guess, where you just get a little sampling, a little taste of lots of things over the course of 400 or 500 years. and so we read those, and to kind of give an appreciation for what came before. And then by the time we get to Washington Irving, it's at the very end of our first semester. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of have an idea of, okay, well, this is Irving's lens 200 years later and stuff. And actually, something I forgot to mention too, is that we also read the introduction to Mary Rowlandson's narrative, which if people aren't familiar, Mary Rowlandson is kind of the forerunner. She's the person who made captivity narratives famous. And so basically it starts with her village being attacked by this tribe and just slaughtering people. And it's a really, really graphic narrative. And I mentioned to my students that your textbook doesn't have this. I had to find it for free online. And because they would have, if the textbook's narrative of it gives like a very brief 2-page history of Mary Rowlandson, and they just really, turn it into this very sterile, like, oh, we had, or her town and this tribe had problems, and it's it's vicious. And we talk about how, okay, well, why was her village attacked? What was the purpose of that? And, everyone goes, well, they stole the land of the people that lived there before. Well, do we understand why it's not that they're not bad? They were just trying to get their land back. Well, yeah, we understand that. And we understand that it's just it's a complicated, very difficult problem. It's like there's not really, they're villains of this piece are not villains, And so I try to show them that life is filled with a lot of gray areas, and is we have to understand things from other people's perspectives instead of just demonizing people. So then you get to Irving's narrative where he flat out says, here are some savages and this is the savage red man, and they, you know, have human sacrifice and stuff like that. And my students then, I think, are prepped enough that, you know, they may not overtly roll their eyes at the line, but you can kind of get a sense of, okay, well, you know, we've read enough and we know enough about perspective that this is not accurate. This is the way Irving is trying to portray it for his narrative.
I guess I'd like to talk a little bit too about maybe the perhaps less overtly racist references within Washington Irving as well, because he talks about the black man in the woods, who we pretty quickly learn is the devil himself. And, you know, Washington Irving does state very explicitly in the story when Tom Walker first encounters Old Scratch, or the Great Black Man, as he also calls him, as, and I quote, neither Negro nor Indian. But kind of looking at it through the lens of our current culture, calling any character a black man and having them be evil is certainly going to upset some people. How should we address that anger if and when it comes up, whether we're teaching the story, adapting the story, when people encounter that and go, what the, what should we say to them? How should we address it?
I think, you know, I look to the textual evidence where Irving overtly says this is not supposed to be, you know, a person of color. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. it openly says that. And so I bring that up as evidence. However, if people are still upset by it, my go-to response in my classroom is that, I mean, I don't really believe in right or wrong, as long as there is right or wrong interpretations, so long as someone has textual evidence to back it up. Mm-hmm. So if I have a student who is upset by, saying that there's racial implications for it, I wouldn't dismiss interpretation. I would say, oh, well, that's interesting. You see it that way. I get where you're coming from. I don't necessarily agree because of this one line. If the line wasn't in there, then I wouldn't, then I would 100% agree. But I feel like the author's intent was not to do that.
It's funny when we're talking about intent, you know, and how that's tied up in the meaning of things versus the way something is received. And it gets so tricky, because I always like to think that any story, you know, is rooted in what its author is trying to say and is trying to communicate and all that. But that also, what I think is so cool is that somebody can take it in their own direction, that it can become something more than what the author thought. But then it can also get dangerous if it's something that is hurtful or is used in a certain way that the author didn't intend. I mean, there's all sorts of instances of author intent and meaning being different things, the way that our culture perceives it. So, I mean, I think just to have that conversation, like to be open to having those questions come up in a discussion is vital.
Yeah. And we also talk about in my class about author biases and how they may not have overtly intended to do something or to say something, but just culturally the way they were raised or how their biases might come through anyway. You know, it's like, and then you sift through and you find out, okay, well, maybe Washington Irving wasn't intending this, but also, like, I mean, it still comes off as racist, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, and so I try to bring that up with my students too, to think about, well, what natural biases come from our culture that come through in our stories as well.
I have appreciated the chance to work through some of this with Cody, and yet after our conversation, I found myself nowhere near content. Racism is so prevalent, And it can't be battled by simply looking at textual evidence and author intent in existing works. It doesn't just manifest itself in our stories as overt statements of hate. It's broader, unspoken perceptions. It's assumptions, never stated but accepted by author and reader alike. Often, it's about who doesn't appear. Maybe we can only fight racism by telling new stories. Maybe those new stories can be based on old stories, but they have to welcome into the narrative the people that have been so often stereotyped or erased. And they have to be told by those people. Cody and I, both white men, aren't the authors the world needs right now. I'm not going to not adapt The Devil and Tom Walker. I'm invested in that story, and I want to keep finding my own way of telling it. And maybe, in doing so, I can subvert the racist elements in Irving's original story. But in the end, it's just going to be one more play by one more white guy. Let's make this conversation bigger. Let's talk to playwright and actress Josie Seed. Josie's play, Petite Dames, is her telling of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. Alcott's book isn't what I would flag as a problematic text. It's wonderful, and I don't want to disparage it. Rather, my intent is to celebrate what Josie has done with it. Petite Dames welcomes escaped enslaved people into the family, and explores abolition and the reasons for the American Civil War. I asked Josie, how does introducing race change the narrative? What does it offer that we need today?
Yeah, I think the introduction of race at a time like that, and with these particular women, and how they're portrayed is the key, right? Usually when you see plays about people during that time, they were on the run. They were not intelligent. The whole play is usually about trauma. And I'm not saying that there's not trauma in this play. You know, there's no way to escape any kind of difficult, and I use difficult very lightly, right? When you're an enslaved person, it's worse than difficult. But there's no way to escape any kind of that life without there being some trauma. But the play is about intelligent Black women who are looking forward to their lives and figuring out what they want to do with their lives and coming up with ways to live that are beyond what currently people would think of Black women doing. Not just Black people, you know, Black women. Like one of the women, it wants to be a doctor, you know, spoiler alert. but you don't hear about that. Like you don't hear about those stories. And when those stories come forth, they're thought of as being unrealistic. They're thought of as being, well, that person is an anomaly, right? But if you think about the stories of these types and of this time period, Black people aren't seen as, you know, people living their lives, you know. I can tell you that when I was developing this play and I'd let some people read it, two of the comments that came up most frequently, and since we're talking about race, I'm going to just be real about it, by white people, one was that the women seemed, and the word that was used was erudite. They just seemed so erudite. Why? Because they don't, yes, a Mr. Master, right? The other comment that came up a lot was, well, there's so little conflict in this household. Nobody talks about the little bit of conflict that's in Little Women. Nobody says, you know, well, those girls didn't fight enough. You know, they don't say nobody was getting shot. That's, I can't believe it. But when you bring people of color and women of color, and in this particular case, Black women of color into the narrative, all of a sudden, they can't be intelligent and they have to be fighting, or there has to be a, you know, a bunch of conflict, right? You can have a play about a couple white people, I think about The Gin Game, that are just sitting at a table playing cards, and yeah. It is moving and it is deep and it is a vision into our lives and how we live and what keeps us going. If you have two people of color once again, we'll go back to the people I know, the Black people, sitting at a table playing cards, and they're not talking about, you know, Bebop getting out of prison or somebody going down to do a drug deal or somebody doesn't rush in with a gunshot wound. It's a boring play, right? How do we change that narrative? How do we change that expectation about the way that plays with people of color are viewed?
Well, because that's something that's not coming from the text. That's right. Something that's coming from the current culture.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And it's, I think that is part of the issue with how people of color are viewed, is because when there is a story that is brought forth, if there isn't some kind of sensationalism about it, that is circulate, you know, that has to do with trauma, there's some people that just won't believe it, right? And so they don't, that's not something that they want to buy into. I always tell my son, you know, if you eat what people feed you, you're going to become what they want you to be. And our country, our world, has been eating racism forever. And so now we have bred a nation of racists. So it's time for us to start feeding them something different, which is stories about, you know, people just being people, because that's what we are.
People being allowed to be people. It sounds so basic, and maybe it is for me, white heterosexual male. But there is intolerance for Black Americans that try to be something that doesn't serve preconceived notions, whether they are living in the real world or populating the pages of plays. It doesn't carry the shock of trauma, perhaps, to simply let people be who they are. But hearing Josie speak, I realize that it is nevertheless revolution. Similarly revolutionary is Josie's striving for inclusion. On the surface, most progressive people would agree that inclusion is important. But what ways can that be enacted in the stories that we tell? In Petite Dames, Josie has given us a chosen family. This is a concept that is of increasing interest to us as a culture. And I wonder how it can help to liberate those that have been marginalized, forgotten, and othered.
You know, not everybody is blessed with sunshine and happiness and sitting around the table eating breakfast. And I feel like your people don't always have to be your blood. It's wonderful when they are, right? But everybody needs a group of people that they associate with. Everybody needs a community, you know, and it's about community. It's about being able to have someone who's got your back, who's going to say, absolutely, yes, you can. Somebody who's going to say, you know, don't stop. And also somebody who's going to say, hold up, you know, that might not be the best thing to do. And when, for whatever the reason may be, we don't have those people like that are blood relations, it's so important to have community. And that's, I think, what is at the root of it, right? Is choosing these people that are your people, you know, that would take a bullet for you.
I am hopeful that community is the key to finally banishing American racism. And stories that are welcoming, inclusive, can help us get there. But there are other responses to our racist past that are far more confrontational than Petite Dames. A few years ago, I had the privilege of seeing Josie act in Brandon Jacobs Jenkins' play, An Octoroon, which directly confronts the racism within Dion Boucicault's 1859 melodrama, The Octoroon. I asked Josie, why do we need that kind of adaptation today, and who should we trust to handle it?
I think the first thing that I'm going to say is I remember when we did that play. We did so much. It was the process was, gosh, one of the best processes I've been through, you know, mounting a play in my life. We did a lot of research, and we, you know, just took some time to talk about what we were about to enter into, right? Because it'll get to that point of your question is who's supposed to handle it. And one of the things in my own research that I found, and I'm going to mess up this quote, I believe it was one of my favorite quoters, Oscar Wilde, who said, make them laugh or they'll kill you, right? when you're presenting someone with the truth, you gotta make them laugh. Because not everybody wants the truth. Once again, here we are back to our country. Look at the unrest. When somebody is saying, y'all are racist. This is a racist country. Look at the unrest. Look at the anger, you know? Mm-hmm. To be clear, we're at that point now in the conversation. You know, it's not like this isn't a conversation we've tried to have in the past. So I'm not saying, you know, it just erupted in this way. But when you are presenting difficult information, you have to disarm people in some kind of way so that they will really listen. You know, I remember during the course of that show, there were so many times, you know, that I would look at the audience and they would laugh and then they'd catch themselves saying, daggone it, I just laughed at that thing. That really wasn't that funny. That shouldn't be funny. Because the play, the original play was racist, crazy racist, right? Everything about it was racist. I'm gonna jump around. We'll address that, who should handle it. So Dion Boucicault, who wrote the original, and I look back at that and I'm like, yeah, there's no way you can't say that wasn't racist, right? But now we have Brandon Jacob Jenkins, who has written An Octoroon, and now it's, you know, moving, thought-provoking theater. The people who are being objectified, you know, heavens, let's not write a bunch of plays about people being objectified. But when you have a play like this, where you have people who are like putting themselves out there in the way that happens in this play, you have, you know, Black people cooning. And I don't know, for those who don't understand what that terminology is, it's when an African-American person projects that stereotype of being the ignorant, smiling, nodding, you know, Black person who is playing up to the wishes of the white person. You've got that. You've got blackface. You've got redface. You have all these things. There has to be a member of the community that is being asked of who is making those asks, or else it gets real, real dicey. And so I'm not saying that it can't be done. Of course it can be done. It has been done. But can it be done well? Can it be done tastefully? Can it be done in such a way that it is not offensive? Right. And once you step away from the community being represented, it gets difficult to do something like that.
That makes me, more than before, sensitive to what I should and should not try to say as a writer, a director, an educator, a podcaster. I am not a person of color. I should not try to tell their stories. What ways can I support those creators, though? Are there ways that I can help them find a means to feed this culture what it needs? Something besides the racist narratives that we have come to subsist on? I have ideas, but no clear answers. There's no bow to put on the end of this, but I can defer to the wisdom of Josie Seed. Thank you for listening, everybody. I can say with some certainty that of all of the adaptation episodes that I've orchestrated for the Theatron Project, this one is the most vital. And yet, there's more to come, because in a few weeks, you will be able to hear a reading of the first draft of my adaptation of The Devil and Tom Walker, entitled The Devil and Tommy and Tom. I hope you'll join me again for that. In the meantime, check out the rest of Theatron Project's offerings, either by going to theatronproject.com or by subscribing to the show in your favorite podcasting app.